You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Curtain up, theater people, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. Your Program Is Your Ticket is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. As many of you know, Your Program Is Your Ticket is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater in smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on this show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. Today's show is part two of a follow-up to my Act Two Places series. I'm calling it The Collective We. In this series, I brought on many, many guests to discuss how COVID-19 affected them and their organizations. As you all know, we got hit hard with a major change of lifestyle and business systems during this pandemic, and theater wasn't spared. In fact, theater has undergone one of its biggest shifts, if not the biggest shift, in the history of modern theater. My guests on today's show are former panelists of the Act Two Places series, as well as a participant in the very last episode I recorded live before the shutdown. They are here to compare and contrast their experiences going through the pandemic and update us on how they're doing as we hopefully transition out of the pandemic, whatever that may look like. So let's bring them on. Hi, Your Program Is Your Ticket alumni, and welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for coming back and being on this sort of cumulative show of all of our experiences dealing with COVID-19 as theater professionals. It's been such a rough ride, and it's been so ever-changing. I mean, the line is continually moving and still does, even as we go into more hopeful times. So I'm thrilled that you're all here and that you made time for this. And I know that my listeners will be as well. So thank you for that. Okay, let's all have you introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your place in the theater world. Okay, we'll start with Erin.
Hi, my name is Erin Kronikin, and I am the Executive Artistic Director of the Scene Place Theater, which is a social justice ensemble based in New York City.
And tell everybody what the Scene Place means. I didn't know.
The Scene Place is the direct translation of the Greek word for theater. So theater literally means the place we go to see ourselves, and we could not believe that that name was not already taken.
Okay, who knew that? Who knew that already? No? No?
Nope.
Wow. Look at you, Erin. Just like coining names from way back in the day, and right. I think that's very cool. Okay, let's bump down to Rob. Rob, talk to us.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I'm Rob Ward. I'm the token Brit on the panel, and I'm a performer. I'm a writer, producer, and creative director, which is the title I've kind of given myself for Emerson and Ward Productions. And we're a new writing touring company, and we specialise in sort of focus on LGBTQ plus work, but we widened that out a lot more recently to, I guess, include stories from the marginalised, let's say, in society, the outcasts, the outsiders. We like those stories, and that's what we try and champion.
Excellent. Okay, West?
My name is West Heiler. I am a director and a writer, and I am the co-artistic director of Artistic Stamp. Artistic Stamp is a theater company that produces interactive plays by mail. We commission writers, actors, and we bring theatrical-style adventures into the homes of audience members across the country in an epistolary interactive format.
Very well said. I thought that was one of the most creative solutions for advancing, you know, your theater company through COVID. And I don't think anyone else has done that. I've kind of kept an eye out for it. And have you, has anybody else tried that?
There were other plays by mail or other plays by post, companies that sent plays through the post. But in most of those, the audience was an observer. What we did is centralize the audience so that they became an active participant. So you became a pen pal with a character inside of a story. And what you wrote them back, what you advised them to do, actually adjusted the outcome of the story. So it could branch in many different ways depending on what the audience member wrote back. So they really had moments of connection. And, you know, we had some audience members send back 7-8-page letters and send back gifts. We started getting, a little heart that came at one time, a little sort of stone carved into a heart. That was what was most surprising and rewarding for us.
Yeah, it was cool how excited you and Shelley were in your podcast over just like the explosive nature that the whole thing took on. Like it, and people were doing and like sending like I don't know, like drawings and like all and collages and things like that, right?
Yeah, we've done 3 seasons now. We've sent and received thousands of letters. I think we're up to 7,000 letters or so now. And we're moving into educational. So we're licensing the show through Upward Theatrics to educational institutions. And we're doing a pilot program with Clemson University this year where it'll be our idea, but the students will become the actor artists and they will write to the audience members. So you get to have agency for both the actors and the audience in a really fun, interactive way.
Very cool. Now, before we go to Neil Markey, I did want to circle back to Rob Ward because I met Rob at the 2016 Dublin International Gay Theatre Festival.
Was it that long ago? God, wow.
Yeah. I think it was 16? Oh, I think no. Actually, no. I think it was further back. I think it was 14. But when we were young men back then,
when neither of us had beards, sure.
Exactly. Anyways, okay. Neil, please tell us about you.
I'm Neil Markey. I'm coming from Cleveland, Ohio. And I thank you, Sean, for having me. I feel like I was invited to the big kids table today. So I am part of Home Fires Burning, which is a small production company here in Cleveland, with the goal of bringing Broadway-style talent and productions to communities that may or may not have exposure to it. So, we bring some musicals, some stage productions, some benefits, and try to get, you know, some sort of marquee talent and, you know, expose it to the schools and the communities that, may not, you know, just, you know, don't have the access that a lot of people do. So, I'm also a writer and also a father of 2 actors who were going through college on COVID, which I, you know, also have a perspective on, you know.
Yeah, indeed you do. Now, while not part of the Act Two Places series, the reason why I wanted Neil to come on is because Neil was part of the last interview that I did in person before the COVID shutdown. In addition to that, his company has also been quite a cheerleader and a supporter of your program, Is Your Ticket. And he's also a friend, and I do know those daughters, and they're lovely. And yeah, that must have been a major struggle. So I sort of wanted to bring on Neil for a little perspective of what sort of like we were like in that meeting and how it all just like blew up. So thanks, everybody. You all did wonderful introductions, and I appreciate that. Now, remind us of where your theater company, your theater business stood immediately after the shutdown. Like, tell us about that again, very briefly. Who wants to start?
We, at the Scene Plays, had just started our 10th anniversary season with a sold-out run of Animal Farm, which we adapted with the blessing of the George Orwell Estate. And we were just, like, ready to go with our next show. We were supposed to do Exit the King by Ionesco. And it just left us completely in the lurch. Our deposit on the space, we weren't sure if we would get that deposit back. So we tried to see whether we could do some things online with it, but it's such a physical show that we just abandoned it completely and really abandoned the whole season.
Well, your hand was forced, so obviously that was not a decision you would have made voluntarily. So yeah. I won't say abandon. Let's just say that you had to put it off, or maybe in the future, and that.
So, yeah, so, yeah, we're getting back to it now. So
good, excellent, cool. Okay, let's see. Let's go to Rob.
Yeah, we found ourselves in a similar situation. So we'd actually just premiered a new play I'd been writing and we'd been developing from a commission from the Curve Theatre in Leicester, about an hour outside of London. And it was called The MP, Auntie Mandy and Me. And it was a sort of exploration of the north of England politics post-Brexit, in the reign of Boris Johnson. And it also explored kind of provincial queer life and coercive control within the gay male community. So we were trying to bring together a lot of different kind of ideas, and it had been received well. And we were in discussions with a venue in Edinburgh to take it to the Fringe in the August. And so we were in that process of, okay, we've got something on our hands here that we're quite excited about. And this is the logical next step for us. And then that's where we were at when we found out everything was shutting down.
Wow. Are you going to try to take it back to Edinburgh Fringe? When it
funnily enough, this week we've been sending out promo packs to venues. We'd like to go back to Edinburgh with it next summer and then follow that up with a tour in the kind of autumn winter time, 2022-23. So that's the current plan with that particular show. Yeah.
Is that when they will actually officially reopen their Fringe next summer, or did they do a year? Did they do one this year?
Yeah, they did a much smaller festival this summer. We had a show that was involved online. They had a big digital program. I went up for a couple of days, and it was interesting when I was searching through the theatre program they were offering. Normally you're talking thousands of shows, and when I was going through the filters on the Ed Fringe website, and I went live theatre, you had a choice of 60 yeah, live shows compared to thousands normally. So it was a smaller event, but yeah, it should be all being well back in full swing next summer.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. Okay, West, please.
I was in Las Vegas doing a show as a freelance director. Artistic Stamp didn't exist at that time. And Shelley had come out for spring break. Our 11-year-old son was on spring break, and we were in tech. We didn't even make it to opening Aaron and Rob. Like, you guys, I sort of am glad you got to at least see your show happen. So that show just stopped. The strip closed down. And Shelley and I got in an RV that we rented in Vegas, and we just started driving, thinking this would be a short little, they said it would be 2 weeks at the time. I thought, oh, we'll go tool around the Grand Canyon, then come back and finish the show. And as it went on, we just kept driving east in the RV, and we kept getting work canceled. Each of us had about 5 gigs lined up. And so we lost 10 gigs over 2.5 weeks, where they just, it's postponed, delayed. And we finally got all the way to South Carolina, dropped off the RV, and moved in with my dad.
Wow.
And it was sort of during that time, when we were with my dad, thinking, what are we going to do next, that we came up with Artistic Stamp.
And Are you still living with your dad right now?
No.
Okay. I
moved my whole family back in with my father as a mid-40s man, which is a... I don't recommend the experience to everyone, but we stayed there about 6 weeks, and then we actually moved to Greenville, South Carolina. Oh. We let our lease go up at our place in New York, and we spent, we said it would be a gap year at that time. We didn't actually know how long it would be, but it was a very wise move on our part. And we've been in South Carolina while the pandemic raged. And now that it's over, we're starting to go back. Shelley was just in New York. She goes back Monday to do the Fiddler on the Roof tour. I'm going back in October because I'm participating in Comic-Con. So we have some things coming up.
Very cool. And I feel like Bridget Jones when I say this a little bit, but I always say that West and Shelley, they're like the class, you know, the class couple photo in your yearbook every year. That's what they're like. They're like perfectly matched. They're just sorry.
We are perfectly matched, but we're definitely like the class couple photo where there's kind of disheveled in the photo.
Nah. You guys are awesome. Okay, Neil, tell us about what happened with you and your business.
We produced the Broadway Princess Party out here in Cleveland for a local school. And it was, you know, it got us all revved up and juiced up. And we're like, okay, we can actually do this. And we were starting to plan everything, and all hell broke loose. And so we tried to pivot really quickly and like, okay, what can we do? And because some of the partners are actors, we got their perspective of it. And, you know, we were concerned about the acting community, getting work. So we thought maybe we could fabricate something to at least give them work while they were shut down. And Broadway shutting down was just so surreal. It just, you know, especially being removed, being in Cleveland, it was just like something you watched on TV that didn't really happen. But, you know, my daughter was in New York, and it was like, it just was creepy. Quickly threw together a sort of try to combine and help a Hurley's Restaurant, which is right in the theater district in Broadway. Mm-hmm. Very supportive of the theater, always has been. There's a lot of opening and closing parties there. So we were going to bring some people there to do kind of a cabaret style and, you know, bring business in for the restaurant. The restaurant was going to give all the proceeds to the actors. And we were, you know, coordinating that, getting lining up the talent. Everyone was so gracious and generous and excited just to sing or, you know, speak or do anything on a stage, no matter how small. And then the laws changed in New York and we couldn't do that either. So I'm not sure what the title was, but it was some cabaret law or whatever, but that was forbidden. So yeah, the cabaret ordinance in New York, wouldn't allow us to do that benefit at Hurley's or that concert at Hurley's. So after that, we didn't really know what to do. So, but people were coming to us, and it was an interesting thing because companies were looking for us to create benefits or, you know, something for their company, different industries. And meanwhile, because, you know, actors were part of our business, they were getting barraged, and for the actors, and they didn't realize the actors were out of work. You know, they weren't in a position to be donating their time. They needed to work. So we sort of put everything on hold.
Rob, David and I actually went to London probably about, I don't know, 3 weeks before the shutdown, and people were talking about it. And I mean, the theater was still open. We went on one of those boat rides in Cambridge, like behind the universities. I don't know what they're called. I forget what they're called. But anyways, the guy in the who was driving it said, how are things in America for COVID? Are you concerned? We were like, no, we're fine. We're good. And then literally like 3 weeks later, it shut down. We did not have great communication out here. Now I'm going to go to Aaron and Wes because are you familiar with this cabaret ordinance? Either one of you? I don't recall this.
I just remember I wasn't working on anything that was going to be in that cabaret form, but I do remember the sort of outrage about it because the restaurants were still open, and it seemed kind of crazily unfair that you could have restaurants open, but not a space that had food and wine and someone singing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well,
was that the issue, or was it that the Hurleys doesn't have a cabaret license?
It was, I think, the former. It was they weren't allowed to do it, and we were planned. We would have done it outside if we could. We were just told we absolutely could not have someone performing in a restaurant during this time.
Right, because all those spaces like 54 Below and Don't Tell Mama, I know they were all sort of up in arms about this. And it did seem ridiculous to me that like a bowling alley could be open, but not a cabaret. I'm like, I don't understand.
Rob, did you in London, did you have the same kind of thing going on? Was there confusion and you could sing here, but you can't eat here. You can eat here, but you can't sing here. Was that happening as well? And in Manchester?
Yeah, there was a lot. There was a lot of confusion. And I think it wasn't helped also because there were sort of signs coming out of mainland Europe. There was, in Italy, and you could see it moving west. And there was a sense in our country of, we need to move fast. Unfortunately, we have a government that doesn't like to move fast, by any stretch of the imagination. So it suddenly hit us. And it was like, right, well, here we are locking down later than everyone else. And by then, it was too late. But there was, it was so bizarre throughout the year. We had a thing in August last year in the summer. It was known as Eat Out to Help Out, where our government subsidized restaurants to offer half price meals. So you've gone from being locked down for months to suddenly, okay, everyone, go out and support your local restaurants. And we're thinking, well, but we, not only 5 minutes ago, we were being told to stay in and only leave, for 1 hour a day for exercise. And now we're going to restaurants. Really, what's going on here? It was a mess. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. As I said many times, the line just keeps moving. And it doesn't help now that, we've got variants popping up, like the Delta variant. And, it was kind of like the same, liberation going on here in New York City. And like, oh, wow, cool. And I'm walking around and no mask and I'm like all confident and stuff. And then all of a sudden it's the Delta variant and we had to reverse course again. And we don't know if, they've shown that the vaccines work against the Delta variant, which is very good, but we didn't know that for a long time. And that was, I don't know, did any of you in your companies feel that as professionals? Like, oh, we can now, oh, never mind.
Well, that's one thing I think we saw with Artistic Stamp is that, we're getting interest from colleges licensing it because they say, well, this is a show we know we can do and we're not going to have to cancel. Because they had planned productions and then the Delta variant comes. Oh, no, it's canceled. And you plan one. Oh, no, it's canceled. Mm-hmm. And I think because, we do a plays in the post office, you can receive it no matter where the artist or the audiences happen to be. But I think that uncertainty, it is lessened every day for sure. But it is still something that we're all living with, I think, as theater artists.
How about you, Erin?
Yeah, we started going back live in June with our training because we train with our ensemble on a weekly basis. But we had it as a hybrid so that those who felt comfortable coming in could do so in person, but we also had it on Zoom at the same time. And we noticed that the artists were still not comfortable. Even though everybody was vaccinated. So we eventually kind of drew the line, the hard line, and said, all right, in September after Labor Day, we're going to all aim to be in person because otherwise, well, we won't get used to it. We have to learn how to live with this, this horrible disease that's out there.
Right. Yeah. I was telling David, it feels like we all died 100 little tiny deaths. The death by 1,000 cuts or whatever, 100 little tiny deaths. And we have to resurrect 100 little tiny times to just get comfortable with just certain things. Like I remember the first time we actually were okay with having food ordered in. You know, we were wiping it all down, but had to get used to that, and then had to get used to going outside, and then the first time you go on an airplane. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah.
It really, really is. Where do you stand currently now that we're hopefully moving out of the pandemic? I know, Aaron, you said you're firing up rehearsals again in a hybrid format that's going to go to all live rehearsals. Rob, where are you and Max Emerson, who is your business partner, where are you with things? Are you... Do you feel comfortable being in the theater? Do you feel, I mean.
So, yeah. So just last week, we had an R&D research and development week, essentially workshopping a new script of mine at a theater in Newcastle in the northeast of England. And it was, I mean, it was wonderful to be back in a room with creative people talking about the script. You know, just sort of having those moments in rehearsals together. It was, you know, at first, you know, we all were wearing masks and we were just checking in with each other. Everyone was having to take sort of lateral flow tests every couple of days. So, you know, we were coping with the new reality, I suppose. We were living through, you know, what it I think is going to be over here for the foreseeable future in you know, communal spaces. It felt like, you know, we had a sharing with an audience who came along and starting to talk about, you know, programming the show and develop. So it feels like we're starting to have those conversations again. There's a sense, I think there's a sense of a conflict in the audiences sometimes. The conflict of we do need to get back to things versus the trepidation still that it is kind of out there. And I think we're still having that battle a little bit. But creatively, we are starting as a company to move forward and look at what's next.
That's excellent. And I have to say, I think that England was a lot more advanced as far as communication over America. I mean, David and I would watch our BritBox app on our TV and watch like news programs. And I would like tune into your news programs to get sort of a bit of a glimpse on where I think we were going to go next week. So that's an observation I have.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Because over here we felt like the communication was all over the place. We'd never been told one clear message. It probably doesn't say a lot about the people in charge of both our countries through the pandemic, does it?
Yeah. Well, at that time, absolutely. Yeah, and you're starting to come back. I feel like London theater is starting to come back a lot faster than American theater. I'm seeing a lot of stuff like reopen pretty quickly. We're very, very slow to reopen, although it's kind of, I mean, it's kind of starting to boom now. Do you feel like things are getting back to normal?
Yeah, no, it feels like it's there. It feels like the audience is coming back. As I say, you know, maybe full numbers, full houses aren't back yet. Still a little bit of trepidation, sort of lingering.
Aaron and Wes, what do you think about that? Do you think that...
I think there's a couple of different factors. And Aaron, I'm sure you're seeing this too in New York. I think one is the legal requirements. And we've talked about those do change. I mean, just one sort of funny story. When I was in Vegas, I was working with Piff the Magic Dragon. And when he opened, they had this rule that he had to wear a mask if he was in 6 feet of an audience member on the stage, unless he was eating. If he was eating from, you know, a thing of rice, then you did not have to wear a mask because apparently food kills COVID, I guess. So, you know, there's like these sort of things that you're always having to deal with. Then I think another factor is, national audience comfort. How comfortable are American audiences getting out and going to the theater? Because, you know, even if you are able to open again, that doesn't mean that the audiences are going to come. And then in New York, we have the added complication that a lot of our audiences tend to be international. And so what's happening in other countries, and if those borders are open, if they feel comfortable traveling, all of those, I think, sort of add into this, and only a very small part of it is organizational. Aaron, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's been an interesting discussion in New York about, well, are the larger theaters going to fare better than the smaller theaters, or vice versa? And because you think a smaller theater, there are fewer people to infect you, but it's also lower ceilings and more compact versus a Broadway theater that has these, you know, gorgeous high ceilings. And so that creates the illusion of being safer because you have more air to circulate. But then you have 1,000 people who are all breathing in that air. So I had just seen on a post of a colleague's on LinkedIn stating that they're having trouble selling tickets for their show. They're off Broadway, and they're doing a well-known show, but are still having trouble selling tickets. And a couple of the people commented that they're still not comfortable going to the theater.
Yeah, I in the other panel that participated in these two shows, we even had one of the artistic directors say she was still not comfortable going to the theater herself. She wasn't comfortable going to a theater. She wasn't comfortable bringing her people in from her ensemble to rehearse. So I think there's just such a wide continuum of fear and concern going on. And we don't know. That's what sucks, is that we don't have a lot of definitive answers. We have a better way through and out, but it's not just audiences. I think it's our leaders as well. I mean, our theater leaders. So that doesn't surprise me at all. What do you feel that you've learned from going through this experience? What will you take with you into the post-pandemic world, whatever that looks like, and variants be damned?
I found it really inspiring, this idea of giving the audience agency and centralizing the audience. We did that with Artistic Stamp. And, you know, I have done tons of shows where you look out and you see all these people in the dark, but you don't really know anything about them. You know, you get them to sort of react en masse, applause and laughter and tears and gasps. And with Artistic Stamp, it's as if every single one of them, I was able to stop the show 5 times and say, what do you think of what's happening? Mm-hmm. And they were able to tell me. And the responses were so different. It was not a homogenous whole. Everyone has sort of a very different reaction to what's going on and has their own stories and their own lives. So this idea of letting actors and audience members somehow considering the experience so that they have a central role and that they are considered when you're creating the show, not rather than just sort of the performers on stage. And I don't know what that means necessarily. I know that the shows I've done in Vegas since then, the Piff, the Magic Dragon, and Illuminate both have audience interaction on stage. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. It might be, you know, at Comic-Con, I'm doing a Dungeons and Dragons thing with Broadway actors, and that's sort of a more free-form improv thing. But there's all these sort of forms that I think are really interesting to explore now.
Wow, cool.
Okay. I mean, for us, we really started looking at, you know, if the world is falling apart and you can no longer do your passion and do your job, you know, you're losing all your work. We had to answer the central question, why theater? So what's the big deal about theater? Is it just entertainment? Is it just a place of community? Or are we changing the world? And so we really looked at that, and the pandemic inspired us to really lean into cause-driven theater, to be leaning into social justice and trying to, similar to what West was saying, to try to involve the audience beyond just sitting and listening, to inspire them to civic action. So you've seen this show that's talked about this particular topic. You've met these kinds of people. What next? And so we're trying to engage the audience in that kind of conversation.
Now, were you that focused on those issues and those items before, or was there a focus and this just intensified it?
We were, but I think that our messaging got stronger because answering the question, why theater? You know, I think there's, especially for us as an actor-driven theater company, there are some thoughts in the world that, you know, actors are just trying to get attention for themselves and they're just living out their dreams and there's no public benefit. And you think about that when you're grant writing, you're trying to prove value so that you can raise funds. You're trying to get a grantor to say yes to your project when there are thousands of other projects out there. But really, we just acknowledged that the scientific studies that have proven that empathy gets created by people sitting in an audience and taking in theater, that heartbeats sync up with one another when they're sitting in a theater together. And if that's not changing the world, I don't know what is.
I think what was shocking to me was the lens that was put on theater and what a void it created when it was gone. You know, everyone who's involved knows how important it is, but it affected people in all walks of life, and it was missed. It was really missed. And yes, I think there was some concern that, you know, yeah, all right, who cares about a Broadway actor who's making how many thousands of dollars a week because they can sing? I mean, really, what is that adding to society? Well, to your point, it is, and people missed it. People needed it. And I think, and I'm hoping, maybe not thinking, I'm hoping that coming back out of it, it'll have a new respect. And not just for the people on stage, the people behind stage, the people who dress the people on stage, the people who take the tickets, the people who are the audience, the people that are going. And people missed it. And I hope we remember a little bit of that.
There was a major illumination of that void, I think. I think everybody was just like, wow. But, you know, theater is scrappy. Theater is scrappy. That's one of the things that I've learned about us. We're scrappy I think that we showed that. We showed how tough we are. Rob, how about you? What have you learned over there in Manchester?
In Manchester over here? Well, I think a couple of things, really, just to piggyback on some of the points that that Weston and I think Neil talked earlier about taking theatre to communities that don't necessarily experience it all the time. And I think that's become a real MO with our company. Through earlier this year, we created a piece that was done, played out over Zoom. And we found that by sharing it, you know, people can sit at home and switch on, you know, their computer, their laptop, their iPad, wherever it is, and that they can maybe have their first engagement with theatre that way. And that sometimes the structure of a theatre building, strangely, can be quite an intimidating place. And I don't know if it's the same with you guys, but in the UK, there's a sort of class association with it. There's a sense of the theatre is the place where you dress up and you know, it's a real exclusive kind of experience, which we know it isn't, it shouldn't be, but it has that association. And I just wondered whether, you know, reaching out to these different communities through a different format initially can be a way to break down that barrier this isn't a place, you know, where I fit in, and say it absolutely is, because what we're doing is we're telling stories and these stories are universal. And it certainly made us think moving forward with our live performance work about, are there other vehicles we can use to engage different audiences and welcome them, not just to our work, but, you know, into the theatre space and that live experience.
That's a great, outstanding point. It really is. I didn't realize this until I started producing my own writing. And you don't realize how much competition that you have that you didn't foresee as competition before, like TV and like having to drive somewhere and having to park and having to get dressed up. There are so many things that prevent people that they just go, I just don't want to have to deal with that. And I think that while we want people to come back and participate in live theater, that's the ultimate goal. That's not the first time I've heard that. I think it does. It's a way to, it's a bridge to get people to see what we're all about. Are any of you intending to, well, I guess like Wes, you and Shelley, I know that you have expanded your, you've expanded artistic stamp considerably.
Well, right. we moved away from single tickets into licensing and into partnerships with schools. That was our big adjustment. So the first three seasons were all individual single ticket sales, and everything we're doing now is all partnerships with other organizations, either organizations that have licensed it through Uproar or people that are asking us to produce it, but we're running it for a college class or for a school classroom or something. And Rob, just I agree 100% with what you're saying. We saw a lot of that this year because our letters would go to very, you know, you can get it anywhere, and we'll go to very rural communities. And when we moved into this licensing agreement, some people wrote us back and were like, please don't do this. You're the only theater I can get. You know, the nearest theater is a 3-hour drive away. And it made us sort of realize, when we think about accessibility, I think often we think about differently abled people, which we absolutely should focus on, but we should also think about people in rural areas. How do we increase their access to live theater? So I just, when you were talking, Rob, I was like, yes, yes, yes.
Plus there's now hopefully going to be a re-engineering, if you will, people are going to have more of an appreciation for any kind of theater at this point, because we've done without for a year and a half. So whereas it was before, that's a little small black box. I don't know what that's about. I don't know. I think that that people will actually start going now, because it's an opportunity. It's a chance to be in those rooms, to feel the collective heartbeat, to see people up there acting and creating art. So I've always said it's sort of, evened out the playing field a little bit. I don't know if that's too crude or if that makes any sense, but things that people wouldn't do before, they did over the last year and a half, and they will do now. And I think that that's important to acknowledge. That's sort of what I feel about it. So anyway, where do you think theater stands overall as we transition into the post-pandemic world? I apparently just gave my answer, so I'll kick it to you, panel.
It's a new beginning. I think there's a new appreciation. I think there's going to be a new excitement. I think there's a chance. And I believe a lot of people over the 18 months took advantage of the time and we're creative and we're writing different things and we're different voices and, you know, exploring different areas, like you just mentioned, Sean. And, you know, I know, like, we were trying to find creative ways to stage something somewhere that was safe. And although with the variants and everything, nothing really came to fruition, but there's an awful lot of good ideas for the future. And we're really excited.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah. I would agree with Neil totally there. I think it's made us more resourceful in a way, almost as theatre makers. You know, it's made us think outside the box. And I think through that can only come more, you know, challenging, engaging and interesting theatre. So, yeah, I'm positive that through a very bleak time, through adversity, can come some really interesting and powerful stuff.
Okay, cool. We'll go to Wes, and then Aaron will give you the last word.
Well, I think we've got to acknowledge sort of the racial inequity that COVID forced us to, you know, bring to the forefront of theater. I think that is going to have very positive repercussions going forward. And I think the investment that you see in every single theater doing in equity, diversity, and inclusion is going to be almost revolutionary. I think this is going to be the greatest change, I think, that happens certainly in American theater post-COVID. But I do see, as well as this sort of acknowledgement of who's telling the stories and who's represented and what different voices are we representing on stage, that there does seem to be a greater openness to styles right now, and things which previously may have been considered experimental, now producers are willing to get behind, and you're seeing these kind of shows coming to Broadway. So it's sort of a very exciting time. I mean, I'll be bold and say that I think we're entering sort of a creative renaissance for theater because of all of these factors. I think it could be a really amazing time where new forms, new stories, new ways of storytelling, different artists getting involved, and it increases an audience base in an exciting way. I'm going to choose to be positive and say that's going to be the next 10 years.
Well, that was a very eloquent way of me saying that we've leveled the playing field. So I appreciate you plussing that for me. No, I totally agree with you. Okay, Aaron, take us home.
Yeah, I agree as well with what everybody said and with what Wes just pointed out. There has been a real reckoning for the people in this country and people worldwide to stop discriminating and to look at our systems and really abolish everything that's broken. Or actually more plainly, abolish everything that's been working exactly as the way it was designed, and get rid of those programs, get rid of the systems that are oppressing people. And another thing that I would like to see in terms of accessibility, is for the union, in particular Actors Equity, to start looking at what it will take for us to be able to stream our productions going forward so that we can have access to our works. There are so many different kinds of people who cannot go to live theater. You know, I was talking to a young woman who has a degenerative disease that if she sits for any longer than 30 minutes at a time, she gets into intense, excruciating pain that doesn't go away for hours. And so while live theater has been a favorite of hers, she can't consume it. But she can if she's at home, you know, where she can get up and walk around and listen and watch from there. Similarly, I have a friend who loves going to the theater, but she's now hard of hearing. But since it's a later in life phenomenon for her, she hasn't learned reading lips. She hasn't learned ASL. So us having an interpreted performance does nothing for her. Yeah. And so she just goes through the world not being able to understand much of theater. And with small theaters, having assisted listening devices aren't always possible. And so I'm hungry to see what we're going to be making more accessible, not only for disabled people, but also in the outreach that was talked about earlier.
Very good. Okay, I lied. One more question. Now, only because I thought of this the other day. They say that ambition is a great anesthetizer. Like people who are super ambitious, they've always got something going on. It's tough for them to stop and think. Do you think that this gave us an opportunity to just really stop with all of the day-to-day and the plans and just really think about the way society is affecting theater and vice versa and make people come to terms with some of these wonderful changes that we're seeing or hopefully we'll be seeing in the future?
I mean, I think so, to a certain extent, but people like me who are very ambitious find it uncomfortable to be sitting in silence and thinking. You know, we were constantly thinking, how do we stay front of mind with this audience we've been developing for the last 10 years so that when we hit the ground running again, we're not starting over. And so it forced us to pivot pretty dramatically.
Okay.
I would sort of say the same thing. I think you learned who you are, and I think that's okay. You know, like Aaron, Shelley, and I made something, and we could see who else during COVID was figuring out how to make things. But I have other friends who couldn't. I have other friends who said, all I want to do is curl up and not do anything. And I think that's okay, too. I think you just sort of had to be where you were in the midst of this awful tragedy that we went through. And you found out, okay, this is who I am. This is how I deal with trauma. And however you dealt with it to come out on the other side healthy, I applaud.
Yeah, I agree with that. Rob?
Excuse me. Yeah, I think there was a moment there, wasn't there, where we all realized that what all we had to do was kind of survive for a bit. And that was the aim, was to get through this. And we didn't have to, there were no other concerns. There was nothing else that really was as important as that in that period last year. And, you know, for a lot of people still into this year. And I think with that came a real level playing field, as you mentioned before, Sean. And I think it asked us all questions about ourselves and, you know, when, you know, if we're lucky enough to come out of this, what is it that I want to do? And what is it that I want to, you know, contribute to my community, to you know, my artistic kind of, the artistic world around me. And I think I, for one of, though it came through a really difficult period, have appreciated the chance just to kind of go, yes, I think this is still right for me. And this is the reasons, these are the reasons why. And I think it's just sort of brought a bit more focus into what I want to do. And also a sense of, do you know what? Go out there and do it and grab it and give it everything you've got. Almost a renewed kind of sense of, because life is precious, you know, as we've discovered, and go out there and make the work you want to make, maybe more so than what other people want you to make.
Yeah, I think, like Wes was saying, I mean, people were grieving, and make no mistake, they were grieving, and everyone grieves differently. So, you know, if you had to just sit back and be neutral and not do anything, that was fine. You know, the sad part for me is I know a lot of people left, you know, or at least, and maybe they'll come back, but they left the industry. They left New York. They left, you know, they packed up. They just couldn't do it. You know, and again, I had a daughter that graduated with an acting degree in COVID, during COVID. She started a career in an industry that was non-existent. And, you know, that was hard. It was hard to watch. It was hard to you know, see. And, you know, she's doing what she has to do, and along with thousands of others. And I have a lot of respect for what they're doing. They're keeping at it. And she actually, you know, she booked some gigs and, you know, good for her. And it's, you know, but there's other people that we know that are, you know, that just had to make a mortgage or had to pay rent, and they had to leave, and that's okay. And, you know, people will either come back or not, and it's all okay. But I do think, however you dealt with it, if you're still standing, wherever you're standing, good for you.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Papa Rose, which is what I call Neil. He's like the male Tom Rose. He can't. No, actually, both of his daughters that are actors are tremendous. I put one of his daughters in a play of mine in an extremely difficult role, and she knocked it out of the park. She's great. You have all been so wonderful. I love this conversation. In addition, you're all such outstanding leaders. And I know I've said this before, but I want to like drive it home. Now that we're like through a lot of this, you know, I told the panel the other day, like you pretty much had a big giant pile of crap dropped in the middle of your stage, and you have spun it into something beautiful, something gold, and in so many different ways, and with such thought and care towards your mission statement as leaders within your companies. And I also want you to know that the vibe that I'm getting from you now is so much happier, and I'm seeing smiles, and it's just so nice to see that evolution. And I want to thank you all so much for being part of this series and then part of this wrap-up show. It's been such an honor to have gotten to know some of you, to meet you, and I'm just very, very excited that you're now part of the your program is your ticket family. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, John. And can I just say as well, thank you for bringing us all together, because chatting with, you know, Wes, Neil and Aaron, it's really inspired me. So thank you very much for bringing us all together.
Good. It's my pleasure. And I think that the best way that we can go forward now is, and I think Aaron hit on this, is almost as like a collective we have to stop thinking in terms of just me and I, and mm-hmm. move forward helping each other out. And even if that means that we help each other out as leaders, or we help each other out through our own circles and our own ensembles and companies and stuff, I think that's one of the things that I really have learned throughout all of this, is that it's brought us together. And for something that I think, you know, I realize it's a disease, and maybe it thought it was going to tear us apart, it's done completely the opposite. And I'm really, really proud of you all for being part of that movement. And so thank you, everyone, so much for being on the show. You're all amazing, smart, brave, very, very, very brave artists. And I wish you many broken legs with your piece of the future of theater as we navigate our way back to normalcy, whatever that may be. And I think it's going to be great. So thank you, everybody, for being on your program. It's your ticket.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. John.
My pleasure.
Well, folks, the 11 o'clock number has been sung and the bows have been taken, so it's time to lower the curtain. Once again, a big thanks to my panel, Aaron Kronikin of the Seeing Place Theater, Wes Heiler of Artistic Stamp, Rob Ward of Emerson and Ward Productions, and Neil Markey of Home Fires Burning. Weren't they great? You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket on the Broadway Podcast Network, who has honored me with a place on their incredible theater podcast platform. Broadway Podcast Network is all about creating an engaging, immersive, user-friendly experience where theater stories of all kinds can be easily found, shared, and enjoyed. Please visit them on my landing page at bpn.fm/ypiyt. Again, that's bpn.fm/ypiyt. Your Program Is Your Ticket is also on Facebook at facebook.com/yourprogramisyourticket. I'm on Twitter at programticket. I'm on Instagram at programticket. I'm also on Apple Podcasts under the Broadway Podcast Network page. In addition, I'm on Stitcher, Player FM, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Pocket Casts, Deezer, TuneIn, Listen Notes, and the UK-based theater platform Thespian. FYI, I appreciate all good ratings, reviews, and subscriptions. Folks, take a little time to visit theater websites and see what they have to offer. We're still transitioning through and out of this pandemic, and they could definitely use your support. Watch their content, give them all great ratings and reviews, and most importantly, donate, donate, donate. It's the fastest way you can help them. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and until our next show, so long, theater people, and curtain.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.